Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners support the Peter B. Collins Show. John Zweibel of Hawaii is our designated sponsor of this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for your help. Just go to peterbcollins.com and click on You Can Help. This hour, an exclusive interview with Mark Klein, and we talk about the NSA's domestic wiretapping and eavesdropping program. Mark Klein is now retired from his service to the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, as it was once known, and now they just use the letters AT&T. Mark, welcome to our program. It's great to meet you in person.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Peter.
I've talked to you over the phone on many occasions, and I thought, well, at least we could have a conversation that initially will not be available to the NSA monitors. After we put it on the internet, we lose control. But for the moment, you and I can speak with our Fourth Amendment rights in full effect.
Well, they're probably picking it up right now, but they probably haven't typed up the transcript yet.
Yeah. Well, Mark, we're going to tell your story this hour. I want to commend you for publishing a book called Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It. You've got a foreword by our friend James Bamford, the author of The Shadow Factory, the acknowledged expert on the National Security Agency. And just take a moment here and tell us how you managed to publish this book and why HarperCollins, for example, is not the publisher.
Well, I guess it's a continuation of the whole experience I've been having with this issue that various entities didn't want to talk to me, didn't want to expose it. You know, and I can go back to the media and Congress and so forth.
LA Times, New York Times.
Mm-hmm. And the ones, interviews I had were just simply disappeared without ever airing, like at 60 Minutes. Anyway, after the Congress passed the retroactive immunity law, I decided to write a book about it so everyone would know what really happened. No publishers called me up with book contracts like they do to important people who leave the administration with a fat contract in their hands. Nobody called me up, and I found it was hard to approach the biggies without a publicist. I didn't have a publicist. So I approached the smaller and more progressive independent publishers, and I got nowhere with them. Half of them didn't even answer me. The others expressed various excuses as to why my manuscript wouldn't work as a book, and I don't want to bore you with the details. Anyway, there were...
But their excuses were bullshit, essentially.
In my view, yes. Uh-huh. There were things like, well, perhaps it might work as a magazine article, or I'm not sure it would sell now, it's the issue's over with, or whatever.
Now, Wired Magazine covered your disclosures and your efforts to get the attention of members of Congress pretty carefully. Wired also publishes books. Did you approach them?
Well, actually, I didn't approach them. I didn't actually think of that. That might have been an angle. I was doing online Wired, by the way, not the publication version of Wired.
Are they different? I assume there's...
I think they're related to each other, but they're separate entities. So I had connections at Wired Online, wired.com. Anyway, I approached some others. I don't need to list them, but only one of them made an offer, but they wanted me to delete important material. Like they didn't want to have the AT&T documents in the book.
Really?
Which seemed kind of silly to me.
Well, and I do want to mention that your book includes some of your legal declarations, and it also includes copies of these AT&T documents. And some of these are breathtaking, Mark, because I know how to read a schematic, and it's just so clear and obvious about what they were doing. The splitter goes here.
It is quite clear, but what's also clear is that a lot of important entities in the media didn't want to touch this. And I found out later that Congress didn't want to touch it in the end either. There were some individuals who were friendly, like Senator Dodd. And that's, I talk about that in the book, that whole struggle to get Congress interested. And as I make a note of a lot, no committee of Congress ever called me to testify. So all their pretense at looking into this was just BS. Because if they wanted to look into this, you would think they would call me. None of them did.
Let's go back in time a little bit. When did you first start working for the telephone company?
I was hired in 1981.
White Plains, New York?
No. I was hired in New York City.
New York City.
Major central office and on Thomas Street, which is a big, tall monolith without windows. You might see it if you ever pass by there on Thomas Street.
An above-ground bunker.
Yeah, you could call it that. I mentioned it in the beginning of the book. There's a number of phone buildings that were built in the later years in the 20th century that were built without windows. And they look sort of gloomy and sort of Kafka-esque, ominous buildings. And I gather from various sources and documents that one of their concerns was nuclear war and that how a nuclear electromagnetic pulse from high-altitude weapons could fry telecommunications equipment. And so apparently that was one of their concerns about having offices without windows. So in there, it was a self-contained building, had its own, you know, generator in the basement, as a lot of phone company buildings do, and its own air circulation system, its own cafeteria, which was not used normally, but was there and ready. So as I commented in the book, it felt like working in a missile silo.
Or a bomb shelter.
You go in there and you forget about time because you can't see the outside. And technicians found that they couldn't play their radios in the building because the signal was not received. Although technicians have a way to foil that.
Yeah, there are always jumper cables and alligator clips.
There's always ways to run cables to the outside. And things.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So mid-'80s, a federal judge named Green famously broke up the Bell system.
Right.
And we had these baby bells. There was Pac Bell and Southwestern and 9X and I don't remember all the others, but... the idea was to break up this huge monopoly and create some competition in the industry. But one of the subtexts that I pick up from your book is the long-term union-busting efforts of AT&T. And so I just wonder if you see any parallels that when the Baby Bells were formed after the breakup, this created a push where all of these sub-companies remained connected, right? Electronically, and you know, in terms of the switching of telephone traffic, the entity really was still unified. But we got bills from different companies for the service that was pretty much all from the same network. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I you know, as a technician, I know for a fact after the breakup, you know, if you were working on, particularly I was working on long distance business circuits. There were no separate companies. You can't build a coast-to-coast business circuit without troubleshooting through several companies in order to connect up, you know, the circuit, right? And so we're still all connected together. But the push for the breakup, I think, came from the corporate world who wanted to drive down costs. And what driving down costs meant, in effect, was breaking up the union contracts so that they can play the workforces against each other and drive down, you know, wages and conditions and health care and all the other rest, which everybody else at other companies is familiar with, what they're doing the same thing right now.
Yeah. And much later in the 90s here in the Bay Area, I remember when I ordered my first internet DSL line from the phone company, and a guy came out from a third party. He was, and I asked him, "Who are you?" He said, "Well, I'm a non-union installer." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" I said, "I called the phone company. Why didn't they send a phone company truck?" He said, "Oh, they found a way around the contract. This is new technology that wasn't covered in the labor agreement with the Communications Workers of America. And so the company is just subbing it out. And sure, there'll be some sort of, negotiations or arbitration between the union and the company. But they just forced the issue. That's just one example I know of.
Yes.
What kind of things were going on for you as the company was really putting the squeeze on its union workforce?
Well, for me, while I was there, what happened every year is they'd have a downsizing. And everybody was constantly living in fear of their jobs. And basically, they were trying to force the older workers out through buyouts. And so every year, there was fewer and fewer workers. And there was virtually no hiring, so the median age of the workforce was higher and higher, and you'd be getting more and more work because the remaining work didn't go down. Mm-hmm. It just got redistributed to the fewer workers.
Yeah.
And
you describe how some people who were laid off as union employees were rehired as either independent contractors or, air quotes, management.
That's right. Well, that still goes on. And it's not just at AT&T. As you know, outsourcing is a common way now for corporations to drive down costs and eliminate union workforces. And they would, at AT&T, they would drive out some of the older, skilled phone workers. Some of them would get hired by so-called independent companies who are non-union, who would come in and do installation work at non-union wages. And that sort of sprouted and is still going on, and ad infinitum, right? And even now, it's still an issue. By the way, the new AT&T contract expired last April, and they're working without a contract.
Right.
And one of the issues, of course, is outsourcing to other companies that do the work and at non-union wages and conditions. And that's still going on. And, of course, another issue is health care.
Mark Klein is with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And just for a few grins, I want to dip into the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives. This is a gem from way back. See if it rings a bell. Oh, sorry.
We don't know.
Hi, my name is Jeannie, and I work for the phone company.
We don't know.
Hello, I'm Larry, and I work for the phone company.
We don't know.
I'm Nancy, and I don't know what I'm doing.
We don't know.
For the only phone company in town, you don't have to know what you're doing, and there's really nothing anybody can do about it. You can try to complain, but you probably won't get through. The phone company.
We don't know what we're doing.
Hope that doesn't offend you.
No. I do have to clarify, though, that the technicians know what they're doing, but their job is being obstructed often by not having enough help.
Yeah.
So,
well, and my perception is that, oh, like the banks, for example, you go into a bank and you see the investment that they make in capital, okay? Nice marble floors and, you know, fancy furnishings and fixtures. But the people who work there, many of them, you know, work 28 hours a week, so they don't quite qualify for health care benefits. And I kind of see that same thing at the phone company, that they make massive investments in the capital infrastructure, and then put the squeeze on the people who design it and who maintain it and fix it when it breaks.
Yeah, well, the old phone company back 30, 40, 50 years ago spent a lot of money on internal training, and they don't do that anymore. And particularly since the technology keeps changing, they just bring in outside companies who are familiar with their particular equipment and don't want to train the rest of the workforce. So that goes on, too, and creates trouble.
Yeah. So, Mark, you headed west. You had a job in Pleasanton, a suburb of San Francisco. And then you worked at the Bush Street central office. That's where you primarily were, right?
No.
Do I have that backwards?
No, I came out. I was working in New York, mm-hmm. and that was downsized. So I went briefly to White Plains and then found this job in Pleasanton.
Mm-hmm.
And then while I was working in Pleasanton, a little later, around late 90s, I found an opening at Geary Street.
Geary, okay.
And the supervisor there a little later was in charge of the Bush Street office, but I didn't work in the Bush Street office.
Okay.
But they are related.
Yeah.
Bush Street and Folsom Street, at one point when I got transferred to Folsom Street, the Folsom Street and Bush Street offices were run by the same supervisor.
Okay, okay. And then Folsom Street is where we need to focus on,
right.
because that's where the splitter was installed.
Right.
And on the cover of your book, you have the now infamous room 641A photographed there. And it's interesting because last week I was talking with Ray McGovern. He's featured in a recent podcast you can find here. And he's a former CIA agent, an analyst who in the 80s was the briefer to President Reagan on a daily basis. And I told him I was going to talk with you, and he immediately said, oh, I want to know more about room 641A at 611 Folsom Street. So the legend is out there.
Well, that's good. I wish I could spread the word more, but as I say in the book, and part of the aspect of the book is not only about the dangers of the spying apparatus itself, but another aspect was the complicity of the media with the government. The media was reluctant to cover my story,
mm-hmm.
and I had a fight about that. And there's the incident with the Los Angeles Times, who killed the major story after they had talked to the NSA director and the mm-hmm. DNI director about.
Well, let's air that out right now, because this is amazing. You gave information, the documents that you have that are now published in the book, and your basic suspicions that 641A was secured by the NSA for the purpose of intercepting massive amounts of domestic communications by internet and telephone.
Right.
And that you supplied this information to an LA Times reporter who seemed very interested, wanted to publish it, and then you found out later that his editors took your information to the NSA, to John Negroponte.
That's right.
And basically, they were prepared to let you hang out there to die because they had the story. And after they showed it to Negroponte, they spiked it.
That's
but
right.
You were then outed to the NSA as a whistleblower, a leaker, a problem.
Yes, that was the scariest time because this was in February 2006. I had been working for weeks with this Los Angeles Times reporter who was very honest and very diligent. His name was Joseph Menn, M-E-N-N. He now works for the Financial Times, by the way. He left the L.A. Times after this. And he was
There's been a little downsizing there, too.
Yeah, but it sounded like he wanted to get out of there after this. But you can talk to him. He worked very hard on this, and he verified the story from high sources, who he couldn't mention, of course. And it was going to run. And then he told me that the top guy at the L.A. Times was talking to the DNI director, who was John Negroponte.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I really fell out of my chair. And I thought, oh, God, you know, what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
So now they know about it, and they probably know my name, and they know that there's documents.
Well, they probably know your phone number, too.
Right. And I don't have a story out there, so nobody knows I exist.
Yeah.
Except me and the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a dangerous situation where, you know, who knows, they might decide I'm an enemy combatant or something, and off I go to a Navy brig like Jose Padilla.
Yeah.
And so I learned later. So they eventually spiked the story. They didn't print a word, not even after the rest of the media picked up on it and was running it in headlines.
Mm-hmm.
The LA Times never used any of that stuff that I gave them. They had obviously agreed, I guess, with the government to not print a word of it.
Yeah.
So they never used it, even after it became a major story.
Mm-hmm.
I learned later when ABC News looked into it, they followed up the story. They talked to Joe Men, and they verified that the paper had talked not only to the DNI director, they had talked to the NSA director.
Which was Hayden
General
at the time.
General Hayden, right.
Uh-huh.
And then they killed the story. And then they found out that the guy who killed the story at the LA Times was named Dean Baquet, who was later hired as the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the point is the ABC News mm-hmm. verified that's what happened.
Yeah.
And that's on their website, and you can find their website. It's in the back of my book. I got a bunch of references so people can, you know, follow up on, mm-hmm. on things I refer to.
So let's back up a little bit. Explain how you first became concerned about the activities in room 641A and what the scuttlebutt in the shop was.
Well, the scuttlebutt started, excuse me, before I got to Folsom Street. I was at a previous office on Geary Street, which no longer exists. That was a leased office space of AT&T, not a central office. And there we had a bunch of routers carrying fiber cable going to Asia
mm-hmm.
and some voice over internet equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And some management-level technicians would work out of this office for certain jobs. These are non-union guys. And one day I heard that one of them was going to be interviewed by an NSA agent. I was told this explicitly
mm-hmm.
and also got an email about it. An NSA agent would come to the office to interview this guy about a special job that would be done somewhere. So the guy came. I happened to be there to open a door for him. And that was when I first got wind of something going on. Then scuttlebutt started spreading that the secret job was a secret room being built at Folsom Street, which I was not yet working in. But I knew that, you know, I heard about the technicians and met the technicians over there. And in January 2003, we had a tour of that place because eventually, you know, they were thinking of transferring at least the equipment in our office to that place. They weren't so sure they wanted to transfer us there.
Right. They would let you box it up and ship it over, right?
Right, right. That was another fight that the union had to have with the company. But anyway, so I found out there was a secret room at Folsom Street, and the guy who was interviewed by the NSA was the only one who could work in this room. So if you add two and two, you get what? A secret NSA mm-hmm. room installed in a phone company building. Now, you should know right off the bat, if you know any history, that's instantly illegal because the NSA charter is foreign communications. They're not supposed to be working in domestic telecommunications.
Mm-hmm.
That's the charter of the FBI. When the FBI wants to tap into someone, they get a warrant. At least they did in the past.
Right.
An ordinary warrant, as mm-hmm. the Fourth Amendment calls for.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI would go into the phone company and listen. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So just the very fact that suddenly there's an NSA secret room was not kosher as far as I'm concerned. And the more I found out...
But aren't you just one of those lefties who, you know, hates your country and you protested the Vietnam War and you're just looking for any excuse to make Bush look bad?
I don't have to make Bush look bad. He made himself look bad. What I am is a student of history. I graduated from Cornell, by the way, as an aside, with a degree in history. So I knew a little about what came before. And this is a reason why it's important to know history, so you know what happened before, so you might make sure it doesn't happen again. And I remember back in the 60s and 70s, it came out that the NSA was caught. Their charter was supposed to be spying on foreign communications, foreign embassies, and they were caught gathering data and building a watch list on Americans domestically,
mm-hmm. right.
Americans who were protesting the war.
Yeah.
Well, so that was highly illegal.
And, Mark, I was doing a radio talk show
right.
in Chicago in the 1970s
right.
when COINTELPRO was exposed and when Nixon got into trouble
right.
and was nearly impeached. And that nexus is really important because the disclosures of the domestic program that J. Edgar Hoover was managing that included these counter, what we'd call counterterrorism activities today, but he was using paid FBI agents and informants to infiltrate black nationalist groups, including the Panthers, and they were fomenting violence. This was not passive collection of intelligence right. and, you know, building a criminal case against a certain set of suspects. They were actively infiltrating for specific purposes that were generated from the very top by J. Edgar Hoover and his goons. And then when Nixon got into trouble over the Watergate break-in, he tried to play the FBI off against the CIA and the NSA, essentially saying, well, don't go there because it's national security. And that combination is what produced the FISA law. And the FISA law, as you note in the book and many other commentators have offered, is the easiest court to get a warrant from in the history of our government.
Right.
And it you know, is barely a protection, I believe, of our constitutional Fourth Amendment rights. But it was something that we came to revere after Bush et al. Openly violated it on a repeated basis. And then in the summer of 2008, the Democrats came in to rescue Bush and gave him the so-called FISA reforms that immunized the phone company so we could never sue to find out exactly what happened, and essentially legalized the illegal behavior that had occurred for at least 4 years prior to that, and probably seven.
Right. That, in a nutshell, is the brief history. I knew, going back to the original question, that NSA wasn't supposed to be doing this. That was the origin of the FISA law, when they were caught doing domestic spying and drawing up watch lists. It was called Operation Minaret, and they had another one called Operation Shamrock.
Mm-hmm.
That was the NSA's program of domestic spying. So if you knew that history, you knew they shouldn't be building a secret room inside a phone company.
Right.
Okay. So it was patently obvious if you knew that history. And that was, ironically, getting back to bringing it to light, a lot of people, I have to say not myself, expected that when the Democrats took control of Congress, they'd correct the situation because, after all, it was the Democrats who, you know, pushed through the FISA thing to prevent an out-of-control president from doing illegal domestic surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, surprise, surprise, when I tried to bring this to the attention of Congress, they ran away from me.
Yeah.
They didn't want to touch it or me with a 10-foot pole.
Well, a little bit later, I want to go into that in detail and name some names. So a guy named Ski, you call him Ski in the book because you're protecting the identities of some of these folks who simply carried out orders.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first designated technician in charge of the secret room?
That's right.
Uh-huh. And what did he tell you? I mean, obviously he was supposed to be highly secretive and compartmentalized, but what kind of things dripped out when Justin, he gave you a tour one day?
Well, I knew Ski, and he was a very conservative guy. He doesn't talk much about that kind of work, and he seemed to be of the school of, you have a security clearance, you don't say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't say anything to me about it or anybody else that wasn't properly, you know, briefed.
Right.
He would only talk about business because he would come in. When I worked at Folsom Street, I knew him from before that at Geary Street. He would stop in to do other work as mm-hmm. his job. He was called a field support specialist. And he did non-union, high-level, technical troubleshooting across a region, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And when he at Folsom Street, when I was there, occasionally he would stop in and chat with the techs, including me, at the water cooler, just to say this or that, or to talk about a technical problem he might have.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want to talk about, you know, details of what he's doing.
So remind us who Bob is.
Bob was a union technician who I met when I arrived at Folsom Street. He was doing the job that I was slated to fill. And soon after I arrived, he took a buyout package and was slated to leave. So he had a few weeks to train me on what he knew about the internet room and anything else I needed to know.
And let me lift a quote from your book. I soon discovered that Bob and some of the other techs had two of these documents, which they had to have in order to know what to do during the installation of the critical splitter cabinet back in early 2003. One day, as Bob was clearing off his desk for the last time, he handed me the documents and said, "You want these?" as he prepared to throw them out. I said, "Sure. Any knowledge can only help me in my new job." The documents were entitled Sims Splitter Cut-In and Test Procedure Issue 2, dated 1/13/03, and Sims Splitter Cut-In and Test Procedure OSWF Training Issue 2, January 24th, 2003. And you say OSWF stands for On-Site Workforce, and these were obviously instructions to the technicians on how to cut in or insert the splitter cabinet into working circuits in February 2003. The documents totaled 63 pages.
Right. Those are two of the three important documents. The third one I found lying on top of a router out in the open. Sims is a reference to the secret room. Nobody knows what it stands for. The splitter cabinet was installed apparently. The cut-in took place in February 2003. You see, they had working circuits already for the internet where data was flowing across it. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted to tap into it so they could send a copy to the newly installed secret room.
Right.
So they had to set up a maintenance window, usually late at night, like 3 or 4 a.m. Mm-hmm.
When only the spammers are out.
Yeah, right. So that they could basically halt the data, cut in the splitter cabinet so that the circuits, instead of going straight to their destination, they would go into the splitter cabinet where a copy of the data would be made. And then
that's a copy of all data,
all
the
data.
Entire stream.
There
was no filtering or segregation at that point.
Splitter is a completely dumb device. It's basically a glass prism that splits a laser light beam. Mm-hmm. The laser light beam carries the data.
Now, let's do a little tech talk here.
Yeah.
Because, as I told you before we started recording, in my youth, I did a little phone tapping of my own. And with the old copper circuits, you could clip on to somebody's phone line and listen to it, and they might hear your clicks on and off, but it didn't degrade the volume or the quality of the signal in most cases, unless the tap was poorly done. But with fiber optics, you can't just tap in. You can't just clip on and access the data. So explain what's necessary there to tap into a fiber optic circuit.
Well, you've got this data flowing through. It's carried on a light beam, a laser light beam. And in order to basically tap into it, what you've got to do is split the light beam.
Mm-hmm.
It's analogous to a TV splitter in your house where you want to get all the channels in your living room. You want to get them into your bedroom so you connect an electrical splitter.
Right.
Well, the fiber optic splitter performs the same function, copies everything, but it's basically splitting a light beam.
Mm-hmm.
And so a copy of the light beam goes to another place, mm-hmm. and the rest of it goes forward. And the copy contains all the information that the main cable does. There's nothing lost. What is lost is the intensity of the light is diminished a bit. Just by the interfacing of the cables, the level of the light, it might be like first you have a bright mm-hmm. flashlight, and then you got a weaker flashlight.
Right. But you can put an amplifier on that to beef it back up. It's
could.
A digital signal, so it
in
won't...
In theory, you can, but mm-hmm. in general, they don't want to have to put amplifiers on because that's expensive,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got more power, more equipment that needs power, and... So they generally try to get away without installing amplifiers, and this is not the only secret room. Then mm-hmm. they'd have to install amplifiers everywhere they do mm-hmm. splitting. They try to get away without that.
Right.
So there's some loss in the light intensity when you connect, make another connection like that, which you might get away with.
Mm-hmm.
It might work just fine.
Yeah.
But sometimes some routers might say, hey, this signal is not as strong as I like it. I'm losing bits of data.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to me one day when I was having a problem with. I'd connected a new circuit into the splitter, and it wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
But when I bypassed the splitter, the circuit worked fine. So there was some loss there, and I had to find a way to fix that.
Yeah. Now, Mark Klein, James Bamford wrote the foreword to your book, and he's a man I have great respect for.
Yes.
He's published now 3 books about the National Security Agency, and I recommend to our listeners, in addition to your book, Bamford's latest called The Shadow Factory. And it also was the basis for PBS Nova broadcast in February of 2009. Now, one of the things that Bamford explains is that when we shifted from satellite delivery of telecommunications to fiber optics, mostly to enable internet traffic, that this caused problems for the NSA because they were, you know, they were back in that previous era where they felt that the primary toolbox that they had was the intercept of satellite communications. But as more and more of this went to fiber, and trans-Pacific and transatlantic communications also were using these fiber underground cables, that presented intercept problems to the NSA. And this appears to be the ultimate resolution that they sought.
This is a more than a resolution. The resolution they sought, they got pretty quickly in the Patriot Act when they were complaining, you know, right after 9/11, that they didn't have the authorities that they needed in the modern era for doing wiretapping on internet, blah, blah, blah. And so they rushed, they put in provisions in the Patriot Act, which was passed a month after 9/11, to give them more authority to get data from internet service providers.
Mm-hmm.
So they got that. And they were, you know, moaning. Well, you know, later they were moaning, but after they passed the Patriot Act, Bush had a speech saying, now we finally had to do the tools to modernize and get, you know, go after the terrorists, well, like as we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was happy. But when the lawsuits came up, then suddenly the lawsuits against the NSA and against the phone companies. Then suddenly the administration started generating a whole new campaign about, FISA needs to be modernized. We're not in the rotary phone era anymore and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Totally forgetting the fact that they got their modernization, if they needed one, in the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
What they wanted was immunity for the illegal stuff that they were doing.
They also wanted everything. They didn't want just point-to-point communications.
Right, exactly.
They didn't, you know, famously Bush said, if Al-Qaeda's calling America, we want to know why. and that was, you know, a specious example because they were collecting information that was clearly domestic end-to-end.
First of all, they wanted to immunize the phone companies. They wanted to be able to sweep up whole categories of communications without any specificity as to who or what they were looking for. And as you can imagine, that basically undermines the whole concept of a warrant.
Well, the Fourth Amendment says probable cause and the issuance of a warrant.
Right.
Those are the two critical elements before surveillance can be undertaken.
Naming the persons or things to be seized. I mean, that's from the Fourth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So the warrant has to be very specific.
Mm-hmm.
But the NSA wanted just to be able to sweep up, all the emails from Detroit in the last 24 hours.
Mark, what is so infuriating to me is that while they were making these claims that they needed to relax the Constitution in order to protect Americans, that Bamford points out that the NSA had communications from the safe house in Yemen to the operatives who allegedly conducted the 9/11 operations, and they would not share them with the CIA or the FBI.
I think Bamford's book is useful in pointing all this out, that basically, before 9/11, they had all the technical means and all the legal authorities to catch those guys. And in fact, several agencies in various ways were tracking the 9/11 terrorists. And they had the information, and they were able to forward it without, didn't need any extra legal authorities. But they didn't, for various reasons. You could list the reasons. Some of them were interagency rivalries. Some were just were shoddiness and Keystone Cop behavior. Mm-hmm. And some of it was just inexplicable disinterest from the top at the White House to listen to any warnings coming from below.
Yeah.
Like there was this one FBI agent in the field, a woman, who was warning about these strange guys.
Rowley in Minneapolis.
Right, taking flight training.
Right.
There were all these warnings coming in, and then they had the presidential
daily brief.
August 6th,
2001.
Only a few weeks before, attack is coming in capital letters on the headline, and they ignored it all.
Mm-hmm.
So they had all the technical means and all the legal authorities they needed to go after and catch these guys, and in fact were tracking them in various ways, but for various interagency reasons or bureaucratic reasons or strange indifference at the top, they never followed up any of it. But after 9/11, they used the issue and the scare stories about terrorism to beef up their own legal authorities for no good reason and expand them far beyond anything they could conceivably need, and also seek immunity for those who had committed violations of the law, mm-hmm. which is a lot of the reason for the big push in 2007 and 2008 to get that final immunity bill through.
Yeah,
was just to cover up their final tracks there.
Mm-hmm. Mark Klein is with us. You got to read his new book, "Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It." And how can people get a copy, Mark? Where's the best place to?
Well,
order
Amazon it? Carries it. That's the quickest, best place to get it.
Okay,
If you're a bookstore and you don't order bulk copies, you might call Book Search.
Okay.
But those are the main places.
All right. Amazon or Book Search if you have a bookstore.
Ooh. Hello. NSA. I just called you to say I love you.
I love you.
Because you really listen. Now when I'm on the phone, well, I never feel alone. 'Cause you're out there with your headphones.
Hello.
And you really listen.
Hello.
Now hush.
NSA.
Don't say a word.
I just called you.
It's enough to know.
To say.
My words are being heard.
Ooh.
And we're fighting freedom here at home. So we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me. Not my brother or even my mama. But when they're on the line, I know you hear me whine. Take that, Osama.
Wow.
Won't you please tell Condoleezza I ordered extra cheese, and I love her.
I love her
'cause she's out there.
She's out.
Here's
there.
How I know. Stain on a dress, but a leak nonetheless tells me so.
A leak tells me so.
So hello,
hello.
with a minor apology to Elvis. That's Roy Zimmerman. Find his music at royzimmerman.com. And also go to YouTube and enter Roy Zimmerman in the search. That one's called Hello NSA, and it's on a CD called Faulty Intelligence. And, Mark, there's humor in that satire. But from what you know, how much of our telecommunications traffic is accessed by the NSA? They may not listen to everything, but how much of it is accessed?
I can't speak directly to the telephone, old-style telephone traffic. The equipment I discovered is obviously designed to pick up digital information flowing across fiber optic cables. And that could include telephone traffic, and it certainly includes VoIP traffic like Skype and Phonage and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't verify when I was there or later whether it carries the old-style phone traffic as well, but although one expert I talked to thinks it does now because AT&T's transferred a lot of their old long-distance lines over to fiber optic lines, mm-hmm. and very likely that stuff goes through those cables along with everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're asking about direct experience, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly,
and your suspicions, your informed hunches.
My informed hunches are they certainly can scan through a lot of the telephone conversations and pick out on keywords stuff that they want. I think Bamford has mentioned, and I believe, that it's a little harder for them to do that with phone conversations. But anything that's digitized,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I think that they're so interested in the fiber optic cables, is
mm-hmm.
it's a lot easier for computers to deal with ones and zeros.
Yeah.
And reading ASCII and letters and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And computers can easily pick out and sweep up all kinds of stuff instantaneously, practically.
Yeah.
Whole volumes of stuff if it's in text form.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure they got a huge database on everybody in terms of text, emails, web browsing,
mm-hmm.
all the information that you do on the Internet.
Now, they also do a lot of data collection. We know that the major phone companies were being paid by the government to sell them our call records. And so if they can see from my phone here that I've made a call to Saudi Arabia or Yemen or to a satellite phone that they can trace to Afghanistan, then that gives them a hunch. That gives them a lead. And then, presumably, they could look up my phone calls and listen to those recordings. Is that a reasonable scenario?
Presumably they can, and there's various, I don't know the, I mean, they could do it on a legal warrant, certainly,
mm-hmm.
and that would, you know, they could do that before 9/11.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was one of the ways they could have caught the 9/11 attackers, as Bamford makes clear, that they had these phone numbers.
Right.
And they knew they were calling into the U.S.,
yeah.
and they could have gotten warrants and easily tracked them down,
mm-hmm.
and listened to the conversation, and they didn't need any new authorities to do that.
Yeah.
What the new authorities have gotten enables them to sweep up everybody virtually without any warrants.
Mm-hmm.
And they make these clever distinctions that if you read between the lines, and this is in my book, they don't, and this must have been written by their lawyers, they don't consider it eavesdropping if they sweep up a couple of billion email messages.
Yeah, that's just collection.
That's just collection. It's only eavesdropping if they take one out and type it up and have a human being read it.
Mm-hmm.
So they can cleverly say, you might have noticed, I think in 2006, the New York Times was saying through their anonymous sources, we only listened to about 500 people at one time. Well, that's only 500 people that they've transcribed and typed up the transcript and handed it to analysts,
mm-hmm.
to read. But they probably collected information on billions of people.
Yeah.
That's what they don't want to talk about. And then what do they do with it? There's no law for them storing it forever. So they could have a database and on you and everybody else, which they might not look at right now, but maybe a year from now, they might say, this Peter Collins is a suspicious guy, bringing back his emails for the last 6 months. And it would be there in some database.
Yeah.
And as has been noted, their database warehouses have been mushrooming.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have everything at Fort Meade. And then they built this huge stuff in Aurora, Colorado. And they got this big warehouse now in Texas.
San Antonio.
And now they're building a new one in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
All this for data. You imagine how much data they must have?
Yeah. Mark Klein, one of the fascinating things that you disclose in your book is a very simple equipment list of what went into room 641A. And the thing that caught your attention, and mine as well, was a box called the NARUS 6400, N-A-R-U-S, NARUS.
Right.
What does that box do?
NARUS STA 6400. STA stands for Semantic Traffic Analyzer. That gives you a hint at what it does. Semantics is involved with words and symbols. And basically, it's a very sophisticated, very expensive, high-speed, computerized piece of equipment that can look at the data stream as it's flowing by, huge amount of data flowing by, and search for and select out whatever you program it to look for. And so it's basically there, provides their first level of sifting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sophisticated. And when I first saw it on the equipment list, it stood out because I knew a lot of telecommunications equipment, and most of the equipment on there was common stuff that I knew about, Juniper routers and Sun servers and ho-hum, you know. And NARUS STA 6400 was not your daily plain vanilla equipment. So when I looked it up, I discovered, and this is real where I really got upset, I discovered that, sure enough, it was not only perfect for intelligence work, it was being sold for intelligence work, and they were having huge conferences in McLean, Virginia, the home of the CIA, where all kinds of vendors, including AT&T and Verizon and the DEA and the FBI, were gathering to discuss the merits of this piece of equipment. So I thought, oh, I hit the jackpot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is precisely what it's for.
And let me read from Jim Bamford's book, Shadow Factory.
Yeah.
NARUS was formed in November 79 by five Israelis, with much of its money come from Walden Israel, an Israeli venture capital company. At one time, most of the founders were working for the Israeli company VDONet, which specialized in live video broadcasts on the Internet. Based in the Israeli city of Herzliya, the company also had offices in Silicon Valley and that's Palo Alto and Mountain View. Among the five was Stanislav Kierman, a husky bearded Russian who earned degrees in math at Ukrainian universities in the 80s. The next 4 years of his resume are blank. But then he began working for Elta Systems, a division of Israel Aerospace Industries Limited. Elta specializes in developing advanced eavesdropping systems for Israeli defense and intelligence. At NARUS, Kierman became the chief technology officer. Among the group of Israelis, Ori Cohen, a balding, dark-haired engineer with a Ph.D. in physics, became president and chairman. And so there's more detail, and I refer people to Jim Bamford's book to see that. But this is a little bit frightening to me, that the technology that the U.S. illegally inserted into our telecommunications system, the critical piece, came from Israel. And Bamford goes on to detail that many of these individuals had history with Mossad. That's the speculation on the blank period on that one guy, the Russian guy's resume. And so we now have the collaboration of the high-tech intelligence agencies, the NSA and a division of the Israeli Mossad, who are at the core of this technology. Bamford goes on to say that Australia bought some NARUS equipment and discovered that NARUS retained a back door, meaning that they could unilaterally access the data that the Australian government thought was proprietary to them. So this opens up a whole lot of potential speculation here about the relationships between U.S. and Israeli intelligence and the extent to which our domestic eavesdropping is available to Israeli interests.
Yeah, that's true. I was struck by that when I was doing research on the NARIS, that it originated with this guy who was in Israel, Ori Cohn, and Bamford has a lot more information revealing that this is not just a one-shot coincidence, that there's a whole forest of eavesdropping equipment that's developed in Israel by guys who came out of Unit 8200, which is the Israeli NSA. And a lot of these guys are connected to the Israeli Mossad, their spy agency. So they, basically, the Israeli intelligence has their fingers in this spying equipment that's used in a domestic American telecommunications system. Another one, of course, is Verint, which it has its own history of being developed by Israeli and guys with an intelligence background.
Yeah.
And that's used in the Verint infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe there's Israeli companies that have their fingers in the phone records collection, which is outsourced again by AT&T and others to companies that seem to be connected to Israeli companies.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not one to try to draw endless conspiracies everywhere, but it's just a fact.
Yeah, we don't need a conspiracy theory to get a little chilled just, by the outsourcing of this to a non-American intelligence agency.
Right. So it's just a fact that there's a lot of that outsourced to agencies and companies that are connected in various ways to Israeli intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to touch that, it seems.
Yeah. Now, Mark, I want to turn to your contact with the courts, with the Congress, and with the media. After you became aware of this information and you retired from AT&T, and we talked a little bit earlier about your contact with Mr. Men at the Los Angeles Times, but James Risen and Eric Lichtblau were the two reporters for the New York Times whose work was published, many people feel, delayed by at least a year, in the fall of 2005. And that was the first public release of information about domestic intercepts and eavesdropping by the NSA in violation of its charter, in violation of the FISA law, and without, to our knowledge, any authority from the FISA court to conduct this kind of a vacuuming of information, as you describe it in the book. So first to the New York Times. Tell us about your contacts with those two very skilled reporters and what happened.
After I decided to go public, it was after that article from the New York Times came out in December 2005 that sort of I figured there was some kind of opening there so that it was not just me coming out with this, right?
And part of this had to be that you wanted some protection, that you felt really naked and vulnerable.
Of course. If it was just me, who's more inclined? I could be disappeared in an instant and nobody would care about it. But the New York Times comes out with it, then that lends more credibility to the whole subject. And I didn't go to them first. I went to the Electronic Frontier Foundation and was talking to them, and then I met the Los Angeles Times reporter. So I was talking to them, to the LA Times first about it. But when that started to get shaky, when I found out in February 2006 that the LA Times was talking to the government about it, then I went to the New York Times and contacted Risen and Lichtblau and started having email exchanges with them and talked to them on the phone, and they were interested. And then I waited. But there was a delay for a while, several weeks, where I didn't hear from them, and that was worrisome. I don't know what happened there. And I was beginning to worry that they were sitting, or their editors were sitting on the story like they had originally.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't finally come out with a story until the news broke out when the Electronic Frontier Foundation tried to file my declaration as part of the lawsuit. And when that happened, the government jumped in and decided they wanted to see my documents. And when they did that, the media became interested, and it suddenly got picked up by the Associated Press and got big headlines. And that's when the New York Times got back to me and finally did an article. I think this was in April.
Mm-hmm.
April 2006.
Yeah. And as you watched this, what was your opinion of the news media? Did you feel that they were compromised and that, in essence, like the way the L.A. Times, in my view, double-crossed you, that you could end up somehow becoming a victim of your effort to tell the truth and essentially alert the American public to the extent of this activity?
Yeah, I was worried about, well, whether they would pick this up, and the first sign was what happened at the L.A. Times. And the delay at the New York Times made me fear that they wouldn't let me get it out. But when it hit the news, when the government jumped in, that was a turning point. That forced the media to pay attention, and they picked up the story. But even then, later, when I started to try to go to TV networks,
mm-hmm.
I ran into the next obstacle, which is another story in the book about 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
60 Minutes wanted to be the first one out the gate to cover my story nationwide. And they flew me to New York, and I was interviewed by Steve Croft. And they had the story all filmed and ready to go. This was in September 2006. And then we waited and waited, and I couldn't talk to anybody else because we gave an exclusive to 60 Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this has really burned me. So through the whole election period of 2006, I couldn't talk to the media because we had this exclusive. 60 Minutes and CBS was going to come out with my interview any day. We agreed not to give it to anybody else. So we waited. September went by. October went by. November went by. Still nothing. My lawyer, James Brosnahan, was talking to them, and he said they had no good reason for delaying it. December flew by. Still nothing. Finally, in January, we gave up. We figured they'd kill the story, and they never ran it. So by January 2007, we went with ABC News and with PBS Frontline,
mm-hmm.
who both of them had nice interviews.
Yeah.
But that was a suspicious, shall we say, event at 60 Minutes that they killed the story.
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, after these very unsatisfying efforts to get the public attention through the media, you became a witness in a case, a lawsuit here based in a San Francisco court, being heard by a Republican appointee, Judge Vaughn Walker,
right.
who has proven himself to be a real defender of our civil liberties and our constitutional rights, up against first the Bush administration and now, disappointingly, the Obama administration. But talk a little bit about the efforts that AT&T undertook to silence you and the ace that you pulled out in the form of a very powerful attorney named Jim Brosnahan.
Right. I picked up these two very good attorneys who were former prosecutors, Miles Ehrlich and Ismail Ramsey. But they, when AT&T came after me, this was in March, April of 2006, I'd gotten a press statement out, got a lot of press, and I'd signed a declaration as a witness for the lawsuit that EFF was doing against AT&T. We got mm-hmm. a lot of publicity. And immediately, of course, AT&T came after me, sent my lawyers a letter saying I was to cease and desist, stop talking about this, and return the documents. So this was on a Friday. My attorneys decided they needed help from someone familiar with civil law because they were more familiar with criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
And the AT&T was a civil law matter. So they lucked out, and they, on a Saturday, they got James Brosnahan to come into their office and meet me.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, he's a well-known, respected heavyweight former president of the Bar Association. And
he defended John Walker Lynn.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew how to deal with the media. And so he decided to take the case. It was very nice, pro bono, and stuck with me all the way. And so he went to meet with AT&T on Monday. And, I wasn't there, but he said it was like a John Wayne movie where both sides were threatening to draw.
Mm-hmm.
He made some counter comments to them when they were, you know, making obvious threats to me. He said to them that you made him violate people's privacy, implying that they had forced me mm-hmm. to violate various privacy laws by wiring up this stuff, right? So the message was clear, and they stood down. The message was that we would not give them back the documents. I would not shut up. I couldn't surrender my First Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided, without putting it in writing, they never sued me. The only remedy they would have at that point would be to sue me. And they decided not to, obviously. I think it's obvious in hindsight that they didn't want to go to court. They wanted to get out of court. They already had the EFF lawsuit to deal with. They didn't want to deal with this stuff. It was embarrassing. And if they sued me, our lawyers could get the right of discovery in court and call for more witnesses, more documents, and all that. And
mm-hmm.
that's the last thing they wanted. So they just left me alone after that.
And the government had no real leverage over you because you didn't work for the government, you didn't have a security clearance, and other than trying to trump up some criminal charges, they didn't have a way to silence you.
Right. That's one fortunate thing that made me feel like I could come forward. I was not tied down by security regulations because I didn't have a security clearance, so I had not signed any papers promising never to discuss secret matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me great freedom. And the documents I had were not classified. They were just run-of-the-mill company engineering documents that were not stamped NSA secret
mm-hmm.
or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody could claim that I was revealing government secrets.
Yeah.
So they couldn't hit me for any kind of legal stuff that way.
Chapter 8. Mark Klein, Mr. Klein goes to Washington. And there's a cute little cartoon here that came from EFF, is that right?
Yeah, Hugh Dandrade is their graphic artist. He did a nice little cartoon at the time.
Mm-hmm. So would you recommend that if people discover wrongdoing by their government or their employer, that they go to Washington and tell some key elected officials who are on, say, the committees that have oversight over those agencies or companies?
Well, without sounding defeatist, my first warning would be don't expect them to protect you from losing your job. And in fact, don't expect them to help you with anything. They're more interested in protecting the intelligence agencies and the powers that be. And covering their own behinds.
So as an example, Senator Feinstein of California sits on the Intelligence Committee.
Right.
And just as a spectator, I've been infuriated by her efforts to legalize and paper over the explicit wrongdoing that the Bush administration engaged in. And you had a meeting with one of her top staffers and shared the information that you had. Tell us what happened after that.
Let me backtrack. The first year, 2006, when I was bringing this out into the light of day and I had joined the EFF lawsuit, this was in February 2006, it was suggested that I try to contact my senator, Feinstein, because she was on the Intelligence Committee. It was
mm-hmm.
her bailiwick, and I'm a Californian, right? So I was given the phone number of her attorney in Washington at the time. His name is Stephen Cash. Called him up, gave him the information, left the message. Eventually, he called back a couple of days later, and he was very interested. He asked me detailed technical questions about what I knew, and I sent him not the entire package of documents, but some abbreviated package of documents that I was handing out to reporters, mm-hmm. which had some of the pages of the AT&T documents and my explanation of them. So he had this. He talked to me. He was very interested, very hot on the subject, asked me detailed questions, not just general stuff. And then his name was Stephen Cash, and then he said, I'll get back to you Monday. And this was a Friday. And, of course, he never got back to me. Never heard from him again. And I never heard from the senator.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get hold of him. I couldn't get hold of the senator. A few weeks later, when I got Brosnahan as my attorney, he knows Brosnahan personally. Brosnahan knows Senator Feinstein personally,
mm-hmm.
and had occasion to meet with her on other matters, now and then. And when he met with her and tried to bring up this subject, she refused to discuss it.
Mm.
And obviously didn't want to meet with me.
Mm-hmm.
So the first year, 2006, flew by. I never heard from Feinstein, and she didn't want to meet with me. She made it quite clear, no contact with Mark Klein.
Yeah.
2007, I didn't hear from her. I'd sent out stuff. In fact, throughout this whole thing, the only person in Congress who ever sent me a personal email directly was my own congressman, Pete Stark,
mm-hmm.
who said, thank you for the information about the NSA spying. I will forward it to the Intelligence Committee in the House. Of course, I never heard mm-hmm. from the Intelligence Committee
yeah.
after that.
And what about Barbara Boxer, the other California senator?
So let me just finish up.
Sure. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The only time closest I came to Feinstein, when EFF decided to go lobby Washington in November 2007, when the immunity bill was coming up, and Feinstein was running around and had just gotten the immunity bill passed in the Intelligence Committee, and she was also a member of the Judiciary Committee,
mm-hmm.
and she was running over to the Judiciary Committee to do the same thing. Well, we arrived in Washington and tried to talk to various people, senators or whatnot, who would talk to us. Again, she wouldn't meet with us. Sent one of her staff out to meet with us for a few minutes. But it was clear that she had already made up her mind because the next day, or that same day, I forget now, I was at the hearing of the Judiciary Committee where she was in there arguing forcefully for the immunity bill.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what she was doing while I was in Washington.
Yeah.
So that's the end of Feinstein. Barbara Boxer was friendly, and I met her, introduced to her through our lobbyist, who EFF had hired a lobbyist to.
A former congressman.
Former congressman. There was mm-hmm. two of them, actually. Former Congressman Tom Downey and also another guy named Adam Eiskraut. Through them, I met Senator Boxer, and she invited me to an evening get-together with a few of her supporters in a apartment in Washington where they were just discussing just the issues of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And she allowed me a few minutes on the floor to describe what I knew about the secret NSA room. So she was friendly.
Mm-hmm. And what about Chris Dodd of Connecticut?
Chris Dodd was very friendly. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet him in person when I was in Washington because he was on the campaign trail running for president at that time, you might know. But he was very friendly. He was just about the only guy in Congress who was willing to mention my name and talk about my information on the floor of the Senate and read into the congressional record whole sections of my stuff in front of a signboard with my name and picture on it,
mm-hmm.
and praising me for being a whistleblower. And so he was right out there. And he was very hard on trying to block the immunity bill from passing and did his own filibuster with the help of Senator Feingold,
right,
which managed to delay the immunity bill for several months.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And that was a window when Nancy Pelosi had the opportunity to basically just block action in the House. And this is what I find infuriating and why I can't forgive her for the role that the Congress played in this. Because this the stopgap measure, the so-called Protect America Act, had been passed in a rush right before the August recess in 06. And then it expired in the end of February of 07. And there was all this threat talk coming from the White House about how it's going to leave us undefended and we could be attacked. And she stared them down on that and allowed the Protect America Act to lapse. And essentially we reverted to the 1970 FISA law for a brief period of time. And then inexplicably, over the next 5 months, Pelosi, for reasons I still don't understand, brought that bill back and passed it through the House. And that enabled the Senate, despite the efforts of Dodd and Feingold, to pass it again. And that's when it became law. And I still am, as you can tell, angry and seeking an explanation as to why Democrats would cover up the wrongdoing of the Bush administration.
There's no obvious immediate... if you go by their words, it was no reason for Pelosi to have done that, and it was very treacherous. And it just is another sign of how they're beholden to secret, powerful people. While they give fine speeches in public, they're wheeling and dealing in private to sabotage their own public statements.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, what happened in February 2006, after Feingold and Dodd had stalled the bill,
mm-hmm.
the immunity bill was passed in the Senate. So then it was left at the House, and Pelosi refused to take it at first, and she passed the bill in the House without immunity.
Right.
Could have left it at that and said, you get it without immunity or you don't get a bill.
Mm-hmm.
She could have stood her ground, but she didn't.
Yeah.
Instead, what was going on, which was not obvious immediately, was that her cohort, Steny Hoyer, was secretly negotiating with the White House
mm-hmm.
to write in some so-called compromise immunity bill.
Yeah, and we don't know what they got for it.
It
was horse trading on our Fourth Amendment rights, and we don't know what they
as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing that they could have horse traded that would be worth it.
Amen.
So they wrote in that so-called thing where, okay, well, let the judge look at it, but the judge cannot decide the legality of the spying. He can only approve their paperwork, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So there's the facade of a judicial procedure.
Mm-hmm. My heart dropped because I was hopeful about Barack Obama as the candidate who had the clearest position of getting us out of Iraq, and I supported him, and it really it caused a twinge when in August, early August of last year, he violated his commitment to vote against a bill with immunity and sucked it up and voted for it. And here's an interesting insight, Mark. At the convention in Denver late last August, I was interviewing Michael Yockey. He was Pelosi's former chief of staff, had served as a supervisor here in San Francisco, and was her chair of the platform committee. And platforms, it's not that significant. It's not like a law or anything. It's just a bunch of promises. But he was proud of saying that, we have taken the FISA issue off the table for the fall election. And I said, Michael, what did you do? He said, we took it off the table. And I said, well, number one, you can't take my constitutional rights off the table for the convenience of a political campaign. And number two, if you made it an issue and ran on constitutional values, I believe you would benefit politically. So not only is it the wrong decision morally and constitutionally, I think it was the wrong decision politically.
Well, that's certainly how they look at things, and that's their method. They don't mind trampling on something that's of concern to civil liberties groups, but if they get blasted from the right and from the Republicans, they immediately want to surrender on the issue so that they can protect themselves. So that's what happened. And there's a lot of people who on civil liberties ground, civil liberty supporters and liberals who tried to overlook that, figuring, well, Obama had to do that to get elected, and it's just a one-time thing. Well, it turns out to be his whole method.
Well, and it's beyond politically disappointing to see Obama's Justice Department attorneys go before Judge Walker, go before the Ninth Circuit, and not only make the bad legal arguments that Bush's lawyers did before them, but try to expand them, in particular the state secrets privilege, to say you cannot sue on any of these issues when there is a huge public record that already exists out there. And courts, including Judge Walker, have said, we don't need to expose sources or methods. We're dealing with the constitutional issues here. That's what's before the court. And we can provide secrecy on matters that deserve it, but we will not be a front to cover up things that are embarrassing or that were illegal.
A lot of people have been taken in by Obama because he's certainly charming and very intelligent and more personable than George Bush ever was. And he makes all these speeches that plays all the right phrases and sound bites that people, certainly civil liberties people, want to hear. But then you have to watch him very carefully. And you know the old phrase, watch what he's doing, not what he's saying.
Right.
So what he does is undermining everything he says. And it's all just for show. Mm-hmm. And I'm not jumping the gun. I mean, we've had 6 months now to see what he's been doing. And particularly in court, he's continued every outrageous Bush position, defending illegal this, illegal that, covering up torture. He won't release the torture photos. This is to state secrets. He's come up with a new one that Bush didn't, sovereign immunity.
Right.
The government cannot ever be sued over warrantless spying. The government is immune on this issue forever.
Mm.
You just, you know,
it's breathtaking.
Yeah. So it's just awful. But, you know, everyone's taken in by his fresh face and his intelligence and his nice family, and he makes these pretty speeches. But watch what he does.
Well, I've coined a new term, and I'm waiting for the DuPont lawyers to come after me. Leftlon. It's not just regular Teflon. It's Teflon that protects his left flank. Because people are not questioning the policy that, you know, we still have 135,000 troops in Iraq, and Obama was the guy who was going to bring them home. The only troops who have left Iraq were part of the so-called surge, and they've gone to Afghanistan.
Right.
And then, you know, he's talking about closing Gitmo, but members of his own party have pushed back, and that's still an open question. And so it's something that we need to seriously watch and not be lulled into complacency, because he's better than Bush. He can string a sentence together, and he clearly has better domestic policies for me as a progressive. But these are critical constitutional issues, and if they're not fixed under an alleged liberal president like Obama, then the next right-winger we get will take us to the police state that I very, very seriously am concerned about, Mark.
I'm afraid Obama is setting up the country for another resurgent right-wing president, because by Obama's approaches to things, he's not fixing any of the things that people are concerned about, and in 4 years, you could already hear the Republicans saying, look, we're worse off than we were 4 years ago, right? There's the war going on. He hasn't fixed health care, blah, blah, blah. His whole modus operandi, even if you assume he's well-meaning, and it's hard to get into someone's mind to know what he's thinking, his whole modus operandi seems to be, do not step on the toes of the rich and powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Try to bring them into your circle and persuade them and gain a consensus. Well, I'm sorry, there are certain things that need to be done where you have to step on the toes of the rich and powerful.
Yeah.
That includes health care, by the way, where you just have to step on the toes of the insurance companies and get them out of the health care, because that's the big, in my mind, that's the big obstacle to health care for everybody, is the
health, sure with you
the
on
insurance
that.
Companies.
Yep, take the profit out of
it. He's trying to devise a scheme to include the health insurance company. So he's going to come up with some Rube Goldberg. I don't know if people remember that phrase.
Oh, I remember Rube.
At some complicated mechanism to make everything work together, and it won't work anyway.
Yeah. Mark, two final points, and these are a little bit off topic. But number one, we know that Quest Communications received a request from the NSA to tap into domestic switches, not international calls like, Al-Qaeda calling America, but domestic switches in their service area in Denver and the Rocky Mountain states, and that the CEO, Joe Nocchio, refused. He said, show me a warrant, show me some legal documents, or I'm not going to do it. And ultimately, he was busted for insider trading and was squeezed out of his job because of that. Now, I don't know the merits of the insider trading claims. All I can say is that I'm not comfortable with the fact that Nocchio and Quest refused, and he ultimately was punished in a way that is questionable. Okay, I don't have any proof of whether he violated the law or not, but we know a lot of CEOs who took stock options and backdated them for their benefit who never were investigated or tried. So do you have any hunches about what was going on with Quest and why there was this demand from the NSA 6 months before 9/11?
I think it's clear, and Quest is one of those examples, that the administration was looking to do this kind of warrantless wiretapping in a big way long before 9/11. And the fact that they approached Quest over doing exactly this kind of thing, and nobody's disputed this, and it was not investigated because, Congress certainly doesn't want to look into this kind of thing, as they've made clear. They wanted to do this all along, just like they wanted to invade Iraq long before 9/11. That came out in many places and has been documented even by guys in Bush's cabinet.
Yep.
I think his former
Treasury Secretary
left and wrote a book saying they were itching to invade Iraq long before 9/11.
The first cabinet meeting.
Right. Yeah. They had an agenda. 9/11 was just a convenient political excuse to ram through their agenda because everybody was suddenly afraid of terrorists, and the government told them, well, this is what you need to do to protect you. Mm-hmm. And so there was warrantless wiretapping, invading Iraq, invading Afghanistan, a whole bunch of other things.
Well, the detention system.
Detention system.
Kangaroo courts.
Right. Mm-hmm. All that stuff.
Yeah.
They had that agenda waiting long before 9/11, mm-hmm. and that's an indication of that.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is there was a program, it may still exist, called Echelon. And from the sketchy information I have about it, it was an FBI domestic program that they used technology to enable them essentially to reach into my computer. And I know it's possible to access my hard drive remotely because I've done it. There's a Go to My PC. It's a public software available. Do you have any knowledge that, A, that was possible, and, B, that it was implemented?
I don't have any firsthand knowledge myself. By the way, I think the FBI program was called Carnivore.
Mm.
I think Echelon.
You're right, Carnivore.
I think Echelon was the NSA's program before 9/11 to sweep up everybody's in the world's international communications.
Thank you.
Which they did routinely by picking up satellite data and stuff like that.
Okay, then Carnivore. Any info on that?
Carnivore was the FBI's bailiwick. And I know they had various processes where they could plant stuff on keyboards, either remotely or just by the cruder method of just breaking into your house when you're not at home and putting a little something on your hard drive.
Yeah.
And so I don't know any more than that. I've just picked that up through Scuttlebutt and blogging like everybody else. I don't have any firsthand knowledge.
All right. Well, Mark Klein, thank you very much, A, for what you've done and the risks that you've taken. Thanks for being here today and publishing your book. Again, the book is entitled Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It. Mark Klein, K-L-E-I-N. You can find it at Amazon.com. And, Mark, would you do it again?
Sure, I'd do it again. I think it was needed. One thing I think I accomplished is just to get the word out as to what's going on, because before I came out, people didn't have more than a vague idea as to what the scale of this was.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. You're invited to share it far and wide. Send your friends to peterbcollins.com. And happy trails to you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.